today, how a change in law could mean freedom for a woman who killed her husband, and why are 16 states suing the Trump administration. Did she love him?
Yeah, of course, she still loves him. That sounds really bizarre. We're talking about a mother of mine that's killed our father, and that would sound really bizarre to people, but that in itself brings you the idea of how dependent she was as a woman on a much older man throughout the entirety of her life.
In August 2010, David Challen's mum, Sally, killed his dad, Richard. She is now in prison for murder. But David believes the trial didn't take into account crucial evidence that tells a very different story, and he's now taking the case to the Court of Appeal. In 2015, a change in the law gave David and his family a chance to try and free his mother. And last year, she won leave to appeal her conviction. It will be heard in court next week. From The Guardian, I'm India Rackerson. Today in Focus, David's mother killed his father. So why is he fighting for her to be freed? What was your image of them as a couple when you were a child?
It was loving. I think, you know, as a child, you know, I didn't really see too much. Remember him buying her jewellery and, you know, and surprising her and things like that.
David Challen is in his 30s and lives in London.
It just felt like a normal family, to be honest.
You said things started to change. What was going on? What happened?
I think it was when I started to reach my teens that it started to become a bit more open how he would, you know, treat her, how he would talk to her. He would fat shame her, and it was just, if she ever was proud that she ever lost weight for a moment, he'd put her back in her box and say, oh, you haven't seen her without her clothes on. It's just shocking. It was kind of like encouraging people to gang up on her. You know, he stopped her from seeing friends or having friends individually. They only had friends together. He encouraged it that way. He isolated her. She started earning a bit of extra money, and because he would economically control her finances, and as soon as he started to see her earning money, he then cut her off and made her pay most of the bills, and she had to always beg for money.
What was she doing to get extra money?
She was cleaning for friends.
When you saw him fat-shaming your mum or treating her badly, how did she react?
Silence. You know, she was just always trying to please him.
Your father was very publicly into cars and other women, wasn't he? He didn't hold back that information.
No, he encouraged it, you know, among both me and my brother, you know, fast cars, fast women. That was, you know, the thing to share with my father. I didn't like cars. I wasn't that interested. And unfortunately, I didn't like women. And me being gay certainly didn't go along the lines of his narrative for a family. And I subsequently found out that, you know, he blamed me being gay on my mother because her older brother was gay. When he was caught going to a brothel, and he kept his nose down for a couple of weeks afterwards. Not long after that, he was found with another mobile phone. My mum was like, where'd you get that phone? I was like, I've just got another phone. Can I have the number? No. So the thing he used to do when my mother was suspecting he was doing something or behind her back, she used to have these arguments, and she'd eventually print off like phone records where it proved it was a certain number with a certain woman answering all the time. She'd basically done her due diligence in proving this, and he'd make her think that she's going crazy. He'd say, you're going mad, Sally, you're making it all up. I mean, this is how brazen he is. You know, he had a photo shoot with two topless women at work on straddling him whilst he was sat atop his Ferrari. He had been sent him out greeting cards 2 years running to friends and family. And that was sort of thing he used to do
Your mum did eventually leave your dad, didn't she?
I always believed my mum was strong. I think, you know, she had a lot to put up with. You know, she found her voice. She found the ability to start the proceedings. And she's had started them before and wore her down a number of years beforehand, and making her feel dependent and promising that she would get nothing. This time was different. You know, she had a bit of money saved that she kind of, you know, get away. And I was with her all the way. And he knew, you know, he knew me and my brother wouldn't stick up for him.
When Sally moved out, David lived with her in her new home. But David didn't realise Sally was still in touch with his father and was thinking about moving back in with him. So you must have been quite surprised when you heard they were getting back together.
I never heard they were getting back together. That was the problem. It was about a year of being away from him. And she was bored and she was lonely. I was working a lot and she didn't have many friends separately, because that's the life that she had been forced to live. And all she could do was, you know, long for my father, because he made her so dependent on him. The one thing we didn't mention was an agreement that had been proposed by my father. My mum reached out to my father via email and said, would you take me back? You know, we're soulmates, all that. And he said yes.
This is a few months before.
It's a few months before, yeah. Yes. I'll consider on these preconditions in a post-nuptial agreement that would be signed. And not to interrupt me anymore. Stop smoking. Don't speak to strangers. She asked me about it and I said, you don't sign that. I think people don't understand how much psychological abuse can take its toll on a person. It is as damaging as physical violence.
What happened on the day that your dad died?
She went over to the family home. They agreed to meet up. He wanted a cooked breakfast. She duly went out to the shops. She came back. She did 01372, checking the phone while she was out. It was a number she recognised. Specific number.
What call that he made while she was out?
Yeah, call that she made when she was out. And she asked, can I see you this weekend? I was like, no. And she said, why? And he said, don't question me, Sally. And that's when it happened. She hit him over the head with a hammer 20 times. Later that night, you know, I come home from work. She pops her head in. She seems dazed. She was out of it. I remember her putting her head in. She was just not with it. I asked how it was. I had a hard day. I was just like, I'm fine, don't worry. Then the next morning, she drove me to work. She always drove me to work most of the time. And as I was getting out of the car and I stood and I was about to close the door, she leaned over the passenger side and connected my eyes specifically and said, you know I love you, David, don't you? After that, she then drove to Beachy Head.
Beachy Head is the name of a series of chalk cliffs in Eastbourne on the south coast of England. When Sally got there, she called her cousin to confess what she'd done and then walked to the cliffs to end her life. David, who still had no idea his father was dead, was visited by a police officer and his cousin at work to break the news about what had happened to his parents.
She stormed up to me, grabbed me by my shoulders. David's dad's dead. Believed it instantly, and I was just an absolute mess. And then it was just dazed and confused to hear if the chaplains on Beachy Head had managed to rescue her from the ledge. So I sat for 2 hours thinking, I'm going to lose both parents to there.
After many hours on the cliff, Sally was eventually persuaded to step back from the edge and was arrested. At what point did you realise that your mum had killed your dad?
I think it was about a day later. There's no specific moment I remember. I remember the specific moment when I learnt about how she did it. I remember seeing a news report outside a house and those guys in the forensic suits walking out with a hammer. And I knew that hammer. It was always lived by the back door, which made it even more shocking that it'd be taken from the new home to the home that we shared as a family. It's surreal telling you it now than it was back then. It never changes. How did it come to this was always the question in the days and weeks afterwards.
In 2011, there was a trial. Were you there for most of it?
Every day, yeah. It was just shocking, honestly. Everyone that got up on that stand to say something for a mother felt like we didn't say enough. It just felt so constrained in what could be done, and nothing bad was getting said about our father.
How much was his behaviour talked about in the trial?
None. It was the QC said you don't speak ill of the dead.
Actually used those words?
Actually used those words.
What was the case that was built against her?
That she was jealous, that she was obsessive. It's something that, you know, always will kind of stick with me. You know, the way this has been heard, the way it's been sentenced, the way it was put out there in the media before, no one had any kind of scruples about them. You know, they made their mind up about our mother. Yeah, it was a hard watch. I knew which way it was going to go.
The jury found Sally Challen guilty of murder. She was sentenced to 18 years without parole. That was 8 years ago. Do you visit her?
Yeah. The relationship is... it's ironically still like a mother-son relationship. Cycle to work and, you know, sometimes don't wear a helmet. Yes, that's not the smartest thing to do and I don't encourage it. And my mum knows that and she, you know, always trying to get me to, you know, be safe and things like that. It's typical mum things. It's just that she's a prison. I feel very guilty to live a life where I don't think about her every kind of moment. And then when she rings, it's kind of a back to reality.
David never felt Sally's sentence was fair. The emotional abuse she had received from his father wasn't taken into account. The family wanted to challenge the verdict and began working with the lawyer Harriet Wistrich, a founding member of the feminist advocacy group Justice for Women. A few years later, a change in the law made controlling or coercive behaviour an offence.
You know, the coercive control law came in 2015. I didn't hear about it until 2016. And when I heard that phrase, I was like, oh my God. Because we always knew it was some form of abuse, but you couldn't say it. You know, that was one of the most frustrating things, getting to that point in life and as an adult and seeing psychological abuse wasn't legislated against. But having that term creates an umbrella to understand the varying degrees and so many ways of psychological abuse, whether it be economic, you know, controlling her finances, my father did, freedom of movement, he used to cut the cables on her car, yep, she couldn't travel around. When I had this term, when my brother had this term, we felt we were able to speak about it, we were able to be heard about it.
What does this phrase, coercive control, mean to your mum?
I think she learned about the phrase in prison, and it was stark, this was a real moment. She sat there wide-eyed like a child. Everything I said was me. She couldn't believe it. And that moment, it all shifted. It all turned on its head. And she seemed infant-like in her understanding of a relationship.
Having the language and then having it, you know, kind of encoded into a law kind of just gives it much more meat, in a sense, and status as a real thing.
Harriet Wistrich has worked on many high-profile cases. And last year, she stopped the black cab rapist John Warboys being released from prison. She's been working on Sally's appeal, which will be heard next week.
I thought it was going to be a difficult case. What is the explanation for somebody who has never been violent ever in her life, who's been very law-abiding, who was, you know, kind of very, very submissive, to suddenly react in such an extreme way? It's not as though she was, you know, a violent, possessive and controlling woman who wanted to end his life because he was no longer any good for her. I mean, it was the opposite of that, although in fact in the press cuttings at trial she's portrayed as an obsessively jealous woman. So that narrative fits quite oddly with the rest of her story. And so therefore you have to try and make sense of how she acted. And that's really what I tried to do with her through talking to her. And once you see the whole pattern and so on, you can begin to feel empathy and understand it. Still quite a huge leap from there to say, well, here is a ground of appeal.
And how have you gone about working on that, building that appeal?
In this case, what we're trying to argue is that we've got a new framework for looking at things which wasn't available at the time, and it's this new framework that wasn't available at the time that provides an explanation which enables us to argue, for example, that provocation as a defense is arguable in this case in a way that it wasn't seen as arguable at the time of the trial.
And if the appeal does go through, what could that mean for Sally, for people right across the world?
If the appeal succeeds, there's two potential outcomes. I mean, hopefully the court will quash her conviction, substitute a conviction of manslaughter, and sentence in such a way that she will be free. The court could say, well, she's got to go through a retrial. That does happen in fresh evidence cases. So that may not be the end of the story if she succeeds. What I hope, and particularly because there's so much interest in this case, is that more and more people understand coercive control, and that there's greater sympathy and understanding in the courts, in the juries, and just more widely in the public.
So what does this change in law and the appeal for your mother? What's that going to mean for her and for you?
My mother's case is a landmark case and a test case because coercive control has never been used as a defence to murder. So it sets a precedent. It's not get mum out of jail campaign. It's we want to understand what's happened. We want it to be recognised.
How's she doing?
She's getting a bit teary now because we're getting closer to the appeal. Been waiting a year since we got permission to appeal. It's been very stressful for all of us. Been put back twice. Don't matter how much more we have to suffer to get a result.
Are you hopeful that something's going to come out of this?
Of course, I'm secretly, without verbalising it too much, it feels like it's doing every single thing possible to get it over the line. I'm not thinking about what you're going to do when she comes out and things like that. You know, I can't entertain that. It's not just for my mother, it's for so many thousands of victims, so many male victims, female victims. This case represents all of them.
You can follow more on Sally's story and the updates of her appeal at theguardian.com. Next, Lauren Gambino on why Republicans and Democrats are afraid of Donald Trump's national emergency. But first, we've got a little request. The Guardian is editorially independent, so our journalists are free to follow any story wherever it takes them. But producing in-depth, really meaningful journalism is expensive, and we want to keep it open to everyone. If you can lend a hand and help to secure our future, then please visit gu.com/infocus. And you can also find that link in today's episode description. Now, Donald Trump declared a state of emergency last week over his wall. And this week, 16 states have announced they are suing him. Here's The Guardian US political correspondent Lauren Gambino on Trump's latest crisis.
According to Donald Trump, there's immigrants trying to come across the US-Mexico border in record numbers. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're really threatening the national security. The irony is that overall, the number of people crossing into the United States is down. And the people who are coming are actually more and more seeking asylum. They're not illegally trying to enter. He went to El Paso last week, and there was massive protests from the community there, basically saying, what crisis? We don't see a crisis here. Trump has been promising a wall along the border with Mexico since he started his campaign 3 years ago. At the time, he promised Mexico would pay for it. It's changed since then. Now it's the U.S. taxpayers, and he needs Congress to fund it. Well, the problem is the Democrats now control one chamber of Congress, and they are not about to give him this money. Trump asked for $5.7 billion just to build his wall. Congress denied it, and he triggered a shutdown. He was refusing to fund the government. In the end, the shutdown lasted 35 days. It was the longest shutdown in American history. Hundreds of thousands of workers went a whole month without pay. You know, they were waiting in food lines. It was really traumatic for these federal workers. And then in the end, the cost of the shutdown was $11 billion. It was nearly twice what Donald Trump was asking for his border wall. Typically, presidents use state of emergencies, for instance, after 9/11, you know, before declarations of war, or, you know, often there's a bipartisan agreement that there is a crisis. Right now, we're seeing Donald Trump use the national emergency to first and foremost fulfill a campaign promise, and that his crisis isn't sort of rooted in reality, and he's subverting the will of Congress. Their first job is to fund the government. They get to appropriate, they get to decide where the money goes. After Trump made his national emergency declaration, he's been met with several lawsuits. The most high profile recently on Monday, 16 states led by California have sued him. They're alleging that the move is unconstitutional and that he cannot take away these powers from Congress. That could possibly go all the way up to the Supreme Court. I mean, this will be tied up in legal challenges for months, and we can expect that Donald Trump won't be getting the money anytime soon. The Republicans' greatest fear is how a Democratic president might use the national emergency declaration if they are returned to power. And Nancy Pelosi actually teased them about this in her response to Donald Trump's declaration.
You want to talk about a national emergency? Let's talk about today.
She said, if you want to talk about a national crisis, let's look at gun violence, and maybe the next president will be a Democrat who will see it that way.
Why don't you declare that emergency, Mr. President? I wish you would.
Republicans, they think he's opening Pandora's box.
You can follow Lauren Gambino's reporting at theguardian.com. Thanks today to Lauren and to Harriet Wistrich and David Challen. Today's episode was produced by Amar Kalia and Rachel Humphreys. Sound design was by Tom Brignall, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We will be back tomorrow. See you.